You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124 and United Auto Workers Local 31. IBEW Local 124 has proudly served Kansas City's electrical construction since 1905. Our cause is the cause of human justice, human rights, and human security. And Buy American, Keep America Working, United Auto Workers Local 31, we build the Chevy Malibu and the Buick LaCrosse at the GM Fairfax plant. What you drive, drives America. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we interview journalist Matt Kennard, author of Racket, A Rogue Reporter Versus the Masters of the Universe. Then, UC Berkeley's Ian Perry explains what wage corporations should pay so taxpayers can quit subsidizing low wages. And, of course, it's Pledge Week, and we need you to pledge your support to KKFI and the Heartland Labor Forum. You can call anytime by dialing 888-931-0901. In the news, Governor Jay Nixon vetoes the Right to Work bill. And our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. She'll talk about a fine for a deadly leak, which she says is petty cash for DuPont. Then OSHA rule to protect workers plagued by delays. And finally, emergency measures to protect nail salon workers after a New York Times expose. Now for the news. Now for the news from our side, June 3rd, 2015. Today, Governor Nixon vetoed the Right to Work bill. Most people think it's dead for this year. The Missouri legislature doesn't appear to have enough votes to override his veto. Nixon came to Clay Como this morning to veto the bill in the foyer of the United Auto Workers Local 249 Union Hall, which United Auto Workers, which represents the workers at the Ford plant. There was a large crowd made up of union leaders and rank-and-file members. Here's part of Nixon's speech.
For generations, the ability of workers to join together and bargain collectively for wages, benefits, and training has lifted the living standards of families everywhere, both union and non-union. It's what gave this country the minimum wage, child labor laws, health insurance, quite simply, the weekend. And each day, it's what gives thousands of Missouri men and women a ticket to the middle class and the opportunity to pursue the American dream. Folks like Katrina, who's with us here from Liberty, with us here today. We tell her story because it's not the only one. She's a single mom raising four girls. And like her father before her, Katrina is union strong. Before she joined Local 249, she was barely getting by, working part-time at a supermarket chain that didn't offer benefits. With a high school degree, her job options were limited. Katrina now works a split shift at the Ford plant, where she receives on-the-job training, good wages, and health insurance. And oh, I should note, recently, as a result of that training and UAW's contract with Ford, she received a $10 an hour raise. That raise will allow Katrina to save up to buy her own home. Wow. And this summer, thanks to a tuition plan the union helped negotiate, she plans to start working a college degree at the same time as raising those kids and working here. For Katrina and her family, working at Ford has been transformative. Think of that. Think of what it was like for four kids trying to do it, working at a place with no benefits. And think of this opportunity and how she's embraced this opportunity for excellence and how none of that is possible unless an organized workforce is fighting at the table to get that done. It's also beneficial to this community as a whole. I think it's important to talk about that. After all, when Missourians here at Local 249 get a raise, or anybody else out here gets a raise, that means more pickup trucks get bought, more hunting rifles, more barbecue grills, more baseball gloves, more Royals jerseys, all the stuff that you buy that keeps the economy going. It means more businesses for the coffee shop down the street, more work for the local accountant at tax time, and more cash in a collection plate at church on Sunday.
Okay? That's right. Amen.
And when you go to a dealership to drive off an F-150, you know, you can have the confidence of knowing that it's built safe with skilled labor. These are benefits that happen when we work together to build an economy that works for everyone. Okay? Now, unfortunately, the legislature passed a bill this session that puts this progress at risk. This extreme measure would take our state back, squeeze the middle class, lower wages for Missouri families, and subject businesses to criminal and civil liability. The special interests who are supporting this bill don't want to talk about its damaging effects it would have, so they've given it a very misleading name, Right to Work. But the truth is, Right to Work is wrong, it will not work, and today, right here, I'm going to veto that bill.
And we're being smothered by acronyms as we fight the trade wars. While we're dealing with the TPP and TPA and TAA, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Promotion Authority and the Trade Adjustment Assistance, now we've got to figure out the TTIP. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and the TISA. Sheesh, will it ever stop? The TTIP is the New Deal with Europe, and the TISA is the Trade and Services Agreement currently being negotiated in secret as an amendment to the WTO. Oh yeah, that's the World Trade Organization. Well, no longer so secret, because today a trove of negotiating text, including annexes covering a wide range of issues on domestic regulation, financial services, air and maritime transportation, electronic commerce, transparency, telecommunications, professional services, and the national movement of persons called Mode 4 in trade agreement, governing guest workers who get to migrate to work, all of that, well, it just got leaked by WikiLeaks. The TISA negotiating texts are supposed to remain secret for 5 years after the deal is finalized or abandoned. Yeah, go figure. The leak throws further fuel on a fire that was ignited by the debate over Fast Track, scheduled to go to a vote at the House of Representatives next week. The documents actually expose TISA as a developed country's corporate wish list for services which seek to bypass resistance from the Global South to this agenda inside the WTO, and also to secure an agreement on services without confronting the continued inequities on agriculture, intellectual property, and cotton subsidies, along with many other issues. WikiLeaks also announced that they have a reward of $100,000 to pay any American privy to the TPP text and willing to leak it. Several chapters were previously leaked, but most remain secret. And tonight's news was read by myself, Beth Pike, along with Judy Ansel.
And that was the indomitable Beth Pike. What a great reader. I'm Judy Ansel. And with me here in the studio is Jake White and Jen Zaman. Hey, Jen. Turn
Hello.
On your mic.
Okay. Hello.
Yeah. So we're producing tonight's show, which is going to be really interesting. And before we get to that, we've got a minute to ask you to support the Heartland Labor Forum by pledging. How do you do that, Beth?
You need to call 888-931-0901. We've got our volunteers there already to take your phone call. You can also go online. For those of you who are streaming, we have it at kkfi.org. You can make your donation online, too.
That's right. And Labor Radio, it's unique in Kansas City. You won't find it anyplace else. Hey, Jake, you've been volunteering here since you got out of college about a year or so ago. Why do you do it?
Well, I like it. It keeps me engaged, involved in the community. I've met a lot of really neat people volunteering on this program and gotten involved in a lot of really good issues. And just having a really long-running labor program like this, it allows us to get really neat guests, guests that maybe a college radio station couldn't necessarily get, and bring a lot of interesting conversations to your guys' homes. And I really enjoy volunteering here, and I hope you'll consider pledging with us today.
So what do you call, Jen?
I don't know. I have to wait and see if they can get a piece of paper and a pen. Okay, write this number down. It is 888-931-0901. What was that number again, Beth?
It was 888-931-0901.
Okay, just wanted to be sure.
Or online, too. Let's not forget.
KKFI.org.
Yeah.
Okay, now, Jake, take it over.
All right, thank you, Judy, and just one more time, 888-931-0901, if you want to go ahead and give us a call and make your pledge today. Early this morning, I was able to talk to Matt Kennard. He was talking to me from Amsterdam, and he's a British journalist who has had a really interesting career, and we were able to talk about that. And he also has really interesting perspectives on the global economy, kind of building off of what we were talking about last week with the World Bank and building from there. So I pre-recorded this, and I hope you guys enjoy it. Thanks.
I was fortunate to speak early this morning with Matt Kennard, author of The Racket, A Rogue Reporter versus the Masters of the Universe. Matt joined me from Amsterdam, the latest stop on his cross-Europe tour promoting his new book. Matt is from England and was educated in both the United States and in the UK. His father, Peter Kennard, is England's best-known political artist, famous for making photo montages such as one where Tony Blair, the former political leader of Great Britain, is seen taking a selfie in front of a massive bombing campaign in Iraq. Despite his family history, Matt was not always a socially conscious journalist. He claims the war in Iraq is what politicized him, and he decided to leave his prestigious job at the Financial Times to set out into alternative media. Matt accomplished a lot while he was with the Financial Times, including giving the first interview Noam Chomsky ever gave to the newspaper, which came after Chomsky, in an earlier interview, said he finds Financial Times to be the most reliable paper because, while he strongly disagrees with the perspectives of the business community, he knows he can find honest reporting in the Financial Times because businessmen need an unvarnished view of the world without rose-tinted glasses. As Matt says in his interview with me, a lot of the material for his book comes from discoveries he made while at the Financial Times, but did not think would be published in a mainstream paper. Because Matt is in Amsterdam and has a fairly thick British accent, some parts of this interview can be difficult to hear. If you want to learn more, you should follow Matt on Twitter. His account is @KennardMatt. His book is, once again, The Racket, A Rogue Reporter versus Masters of the Universe. We're lucky to have Matt joining us this week, 1 week after we had Sasha Chavkin speak to us about the World Bank. According to Matt, the World Bank is part of The Racket, which is essentially how American financial institutions control the outcomes politically and economically across the world using both American political strength and American military might.
I'm So I have a friend, and he's from Nicaragua, and he went to grad school at Harvard, and he just for fun decided to take an undergrad class last year, and he took it with Neil Ferguson, and one of the first questions Ferguson asked was, do you think that the West enriches itself off of poor countries? And he was surprised that that was, you know, even a question. But how much do you think that elite educational institutions in the U.S. and the U.K., I know you've had some experiences there, so could you tell us about some of your experiences and about how much you think they shape the ideology?
Yes, that's a good question.
Sorry about that, guys, but it is a bit hard to hear what Matt is saying in that interview, so I'm just going to go ahead and talk a little bit about what Matt was saying because it was so unclear. So Matt was a journalism student at Columbia University, and he was talking about how difficult it was as a Columbia student to try to, be a career-oriented journalist while still holding on to his principles. So one time he stood up and challenged a speaker that came and spoke at the university, and he got in a lot of trouble for that. And so we were just talking about how when he was at school in England, you know, he went to a school that wasn't quite as prestigious as where he went in America, which was Columbia University, and he said there was a lot more opportunity to have open conversations, you know, like the kind of open conversations that we have on KKFI and on Heartland Radio all day. And Matt also then talked a little bit about the World Bank and about how I told him that some of our guests or some of our volunteers had recently come back from Honduras, including Judy, and he was telling me about sort of the history of Honduras and the history of Latin America and about Latin America's relationship with the United States, which Judy could tell you more about too, and also talking just about Haiti and labor conditions in Haiti and why Americans workers are losing jobs to sweatshops in places like Haiti, where you can make as little as $2.30 a day. And yeah, so we had a really interesting conversation. It's too bad that recording really didn't sound too good. I hope that doesn't change your mind or anything, and we're just gonna go on, keep on chugging ahead. Sean's gonna be on at 6:30 with an interview with someone from Berkeley, California, about how much a fair wage should be. And another big thing that happened today was that Governor Nixon agreed with Mayor Slay, the mayor of St. Louis, about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour in St. Louis. So I think that's a really promising development for labor in Kansas City across the state of Missouri. And we really appreciate that Governor Nixon did that today.
That's cool.
You know, I don't think Mayor Sly James has endorsed 15 yet.
I've not heard anything like that from Mayor James.
I think it will put a little pressure on him. There's a press conference tomorrow that's being done by the folks who are supporting a raise in the Kansas City minimum wage. It'll be in front of City Hall at noon. So people should come on down and hear what it's all about. I want to thank Dave Pennington. Dave Pennington made a pledge to the Heartland Labor Forum. Dave's a member of the Teamsters, and he wants to challenge all sustainers, you know who you are, and all union members, and you better know who you are, to make a pledge to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And you can do that by calling our phone number at 888-931-0901. Or pledging online at kkfi.org. Union members, to the barricades. Support Labor Radio.
That's right.
We're under attack.
Well, and that fight for 15 has been a topic, a really hot topic. Absolutely. Here on the Heartland Labor Forum. And we've appreciated everyone who's listened in and you know, given their support during past shows. We also just want to thank everyone who has donated during the pledge drive so far this time around.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
We can't do it without you.
That's right. And thanks to all the volunteers who have come in to cover the phone lines. And, you know, 888-931-0901. We have our standard gifts, our thank you gifts. You can pick up the T-shirt, the KKFI official collector's T-shirt, for $90 or more. For $150, it's a guest DJ.
Yep.
And this one, I think that's just really cool.
It is the actual, that's how I got my start in getting a show here, was going on Mark Manning's show.
Really?
A year and a half ago. And so here I am.
You have a show, Jen?
Well, it's the...
Her Mind the Gap.
It's the monthly.
Yeah.
It's monthly, right. I thought maybe... there was some news.
Not yet. No, I think the whole world would hear.
But there's been several of the programmers who came and started as guest DJs.
Exactly.
And now look, they're in a programming spot. I mean, how fun. You get to pick out your music that you love, and you come in and you back announce it, and the engineer does all the work for
exactly.
you. Exactly. So you don't have to have any of the stress.
Easiest job in the world.
And 888-931-0901, you can pick up that guest DJ.
That's right, because this is volunteer run radio. This is community radio. We have to pay the bill, light bill. We got to pay for equipment repairs. We got to keep maintenance. There's a few folks that have their staff, but most everybody else is doing a radio show. These are all volunteers, just like everybody out there in the community. You know, like I said, you can come on and be a guest DJ for $150 or more, or for $90 or more, you get a T-shirt.
And $200, you can get both.
You can get both. Well, there you go. But this is the only place you're going to hear, this is the only media in the city right now on broadcast media that will talk about labor issues from the working person's perspective.
I mean, is there any place that's in any community radio station that does a local one besides us? Is there anyone?
Oh, yeah, there's several.
There are?
Yeah, there are some labor shows around the country. Probably the most,
I'll say, but
in New York City there's one, in Madison, Wisconsin there's one.
But not in Kansas City.
Not in this region.
Kansas City.
Not even in this region. Yeah.
And you might get some labor news in the local paper, but even that's been cut back.
Exactly.
You know,
or biased.
You know, so this is the only place you're going to get consistent coverage from the workers' perspective.
Right.
And we all volunteer for this, so we do need you to help us out if you can. With a pledge of as much as you can afford to give, 888-931-0901.
And an easy way to do it, too, is the sustaining giving.
Yeah, sustaining giving is a great way. It's my favorite way of pledging, because you know your dollar stretches farther, and it goes. It's a reliable, steady source of income for us to rely on.
We can plan.
Yeah, we can plan ahead for it. You know, like for example, if you're looking at the T-shirt and saying, "Yeah, gosh, I really love it, but you know, I just paid rent. I don't have $90 to pledge." But I can give you $10 a month, and so that's $100 a year. You know, that is
you're
a lot.
There. You've got the T-shirt.
Exactly.
You get the T-shirt, right?
And you get exactly. Yeah. And you know, and so you can do that, and it's just a great way to make you feel good about supporting the things that you love, the radio that you love, the programs that you love. And that's the thing. You know, we're not paid. You know, we're here because this is something that we believe in, we're passionate about, and we want to bring these underserved genres and underserved news items to you, and give you what you want. We're not beholden to corporations here.
You know, I was just in Honduras, and I was in this town on the beach of Afro-Indigenous people who are in danger of losing their land to tourist development.
Wow.
Very poor people, and they have a community radio station.
Amazing.
And they took me to see it, and it's like this two-room building with an air conditioner.
Oh, wow.
For the equipment, you know. They right. made sure we understood. It was super hot there. They made sure we understood that the air conditioner was for the equipment
yeah.
you know. And I saw their version of the board. And, you know, trouble is they have power outages all the time.
Right.
And they just have to go off the air. But for them, where the media is just as corporate in that country, this is a vital link to their community. And they have people spread in a pretty large area. These are the Garifuna people. And so for them, community radio equals democracy.
Well, and it's strength in numbers.
And and Belize. Belize in Central America has the same thing.
Yeah.
There's a little small island, Ambergris Key, and they have a little community radio station. And I think it's run by the same group of people.
Well, there's a whole network of those kind of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, supporting your community radio station is what we're looking for tonight at 888-931-0901. You can make your pledge, or you can go online at kkfi.org.
Oh, looks like we've got a pledge
and support
right now.
The Heartland Labor Forum.
Who do you want to thank, Jake?
All right, we have a very special pledge coming from someone who, no matter what, will always love me, and I appreciate that. That's my mom.
Yay! Thanks, Mom. Oh, Mrs. White. Woohoo!
Coming all through. Right. Big time today, and she is going to qualify for a T-shirt.
All right. Way to go.
Amazing.
And big up Jake's mom.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mom. I love you, and thanks for tuning in.
We love you, too.
Thanks, Mom.
And if you want to also donate, you guys can do that at
888-931-0109.
Nope. 0901. I'm sorry. 888-931-0901.
Oh. Great. Okay. And we're getting to put getting ready to put Sean on, who is going to be interviewing someone who wrote the study of the low wage workers' dependence on public assistance. Mm-hmm. And how much money the taxpayers are actually subsidizing these huge corporations like McDonald's because they don't pay a living wage.
Wow.
And so we're going to find out about that study. And hopefully, you know, here in Kansas City, we're fighting for an increase in the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a race because the legislature is trying to preempt cities from being able to pass their own minimum wage. You know, these are the small government folks in the legislature who think that government shouldn't tell anybody what to do. Right. And so they're preempting us from, you know, like it started as a plastic bag bill. Okay. The bill started, it was to preempt cities from passing legislation that banned plastic bags. Okay.
Seriously.
So then they heard that people were thinking of raising the minimum wage. And so they added the minimum wage on there, and I think they added sick leave ordinances and anything that might benefit workers. So that's a fight that's going on right now. And so many people who would benefit from increasing the minimum wage would be people who are now getting food stamps and child care assistance.
Other subsidies,
yeah.
Right.
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 So
So again, you know, we'll just ask people before we get started to show their support, 888-931-0901, and pledge for the Heartland Labor Forum. It's on every Thursday night at 6 p.m., and then we rebroadcast at 5 a.m. We have the great thank you gifts to give away, $90 for the T-shirt, $150 for the guest DJ, and $200. We put it together. It's a combo package, 888-931-0901.
Thanks, Beth. Now for Sean.
Hello, folks. I'm Sean Saving, and tonight we're going to be talking about the high public cost of low wages. It seems that a year can't go by without a fight in Congress and many states over budget deficits. Whether the economy is doing well or doing poorly, conservatives never seem to waver from their desire to cut the waste. And some of their targets, of course, are social programs. They must be reformed, they cry. We're fostering dependency on the government. People have no incentive to work when they can get a check from the government. You know, the tired old argument goes, and believe me, it is tired. You can find the same apologists for the bosses saying these same things since the creation of unemployment and Social Security insurance under FDR. Yet as anyone who has ever had a lousy paying job knows, having a job is no guarantee of not being poor. According to the Economic Policy Institute, 35 million Americans make less than $10.55 an hour, or just over $20,000 a year. While a single person living in an affordable city might be able to get by on that, raising a family would be nearly impossible without some form of assistance. And that is what many working poor do, turn to the government programs to make ends meet. And while employers argue they pay competitive wages and that to pay more would be an economic hardship on the company, public tax dollars flow to their employees through a number of programs, Medicaid, food stamps, subsidized housing, and so on. Effectively, through these public assistance programs, our tax dollars subsidize the wages of some of the world's largest corporations. In a study released this spring, the University of California Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education examined just how much public assistance is going to people who work. The report, The High Public Cost of Low Wages, estimates that poverty-level wages cost U.S. taxpayers $153 billion each year in public support for working families. Joining us tonight is one of the co-authors of this study, Ian Perry, a research and data analyst at the Center for Labor Research and Education. Mr. Perry, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So in your study, you focus on the working family that receives public assistance. Could you define what the working family is for your study?
Sure, Sean. It's we call a working family is any family that has at least one family member working at least 10 hours a week and 27 weeks per year.
So 10 hours a week for about basically half a year, that kind of seems like a low threshold. I mean, why'd you pick that number?
So we picked that to stay consistent with some of our prior research on fast food workers and that low threshold you kind of need for fast food workers because they have a tendency to kind of work, some of them at least are working kind of lower amounts. And so if you want to capture the whole industry, you need to kind of have that more expansive definition.
Make sure you get your part-time workers. Okay.
Even though we wanted to stay consistent, we still looked at what would happen if we used a kind of more standard definition of kind of working. And so if you raise that bar from 10 hours to 30 hours a week, the total is still $133 billion a year.
Wow.
And so that's only 13% less. And then if you raise the weeks per year to 48 weeks per year and keep the 30 hours a week, it's still $118 billion, which is only a 23% decline from, you know, our kind of published headline number.
Right.
So even though that number is a little, it might be a low threshold, coming up with a higher number doesn't really substantially change what we find.
Right. So you couldn't look at all public assistance programs, but you did look at the biggest ones. Could you tell us which ones those are?
Sure. We looked at the Earned Income Tax Credit, Medicaid and CHIP. CHIP is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Cash assistance, the cash assistance portion of TANF, or temporary assistance for needy families, and then SNAP, or what was formerly known as food stamps.
And the Earned Income Tax Credit, explain to people how that works real quickly, if you could.
Sure. It's basically a wage subsidy for low income workers. So at kind of tax filing time, they get kind of a larger tax refund that helps to boost their income.
Okay. Okay. So you get that back sort of once a year as part of your refund check as a credit, a tax credit on your taxes. Okay.
Exactly.
And then Medicaid, CHIP is Medicaid. What most people understand is Medicaid. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Medicaid and CHIP are both healthcare programs.
Okay.
CHIP is a children-specific program.
Okay.
And Medicaid is for adults and children.
And then TAMF, is that your traditional, what we used to call welfare? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. That's what kind of used to be known as welfare.
That's a check for a few hundred bucks a month, right? Or,
yeah. So basically, with the welfare reform in the 90s, that's where the TANF name came from. But
SNAP is your food. It used to be called food stamps. SNAP is food stamps, right? Essentially.
Yep, and SNAP is food stamps. Okay. It's kind of.
So what did you find was going on here? So if we're talking about workers who, a working family receives, is that a person who works at least 10 hours a week for 27 weeks a year, and of course that's not very much money, so they're getting public assistance. And what did you find, what percentage of these programs is going to families who have at least that one worker in the family working that minimum amount at least?
Sure. So for the healthcare programs, Medicaid and CHIP, it's 55% of the total program spending, which is about $69 billion a year, is going to working families. Now, this is prior to the ACA, and so with the expansion of the ACA, that number is probably higher now.
Because Medicaid expanded in some states, correct?
Right, course.
Right, okay.
Not all states, but in the states that have expanded, it would raise that number. For the earned income tax credit, because that's targeted at low-income workers, about 81% of that is going to working families, and that's about $54 billion a year. Food stamps comes in around 38%, or $27 billion a year, and TANF, or formerly known as welfare, is about 27% of that is going to working families. And that's only about $3 billion a year.
I see. So you did exclude a couple of programs, though, because you couldn't, the data don't match up, right, with what you're trying to
do?
Yeah,
exactly. So we wanted to focus only on kind of major income-tested programs, because obviously we want to look at programs that are meant for low-income families and individuals. And we also wanted ones that were direct assistance instead of kind of more indirect aid like job training or educational programs.
Right.
And then there are some other programs that we might wanted to have included in our study, but basically you can't get good data on them. And so that would include things like child care assistance and reduced price school lunches. Some states have their own EITC programs. And we can't include those because we just don't have the data.
Yeah, it'd be much harder to quantify what the subsidy is for a reduced school lunch program. Probably, I could see how that would be difficult. So this is a conservative estimate.
Yep.
And those the programs that you mentioned, though, are actually rather small. They're all, in the single-digit billions of dollar a year programs, right? So we're not talking.
Yeah. So these are the ones that we had to leave out are definitely smaller. EITC, Medicaid, and SNAP, those are really the big ones.
Yeah, you'll get
we have those.
$227 billion.
Healthcare is also a bit sizable, but it's not on the same scale as those.
So out of $227 billion for those four programs, $128 billion, roughly 56%, went to people who are working. So this idea that all these people receiving welfare benefits are just lazy and not doing anything. Well, they have jobs. I mean, that's the message here, that these people are working and they're just not making enough money, or they can't get enough hours.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the major takeaways from this, is that that conception of people on public assistance isn't really true. Most of the people on a number of these programs are working. You know, we've talked about the money side of the ledger, but working families make up 61% of the families that are on Medicaid, and 74% of the families receiving EITC. And they're about a third each of families on food stamps and welfare. So the idea that, you know, these benefits are going to people who aren't working, or, you know, these programs are keeping them from working, is not really accurate.
Right, right. And of course, if you were, and then, you know, if you work too much, you don't qualify because you can make a little bit more money than you, you know, than the cutoff is, and then you're out of the program entirely too. Is that's a that's one of the drawbacks of the way this is done as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is possible for that to occur. Some of the programs have that kind of issue built, you know, kind of built into their design. The Earned Income Tax Credit, actually, the kind of amount of money that you can receive is, it's kind of like an upside-down U-shape, where as you make more, the credit can actually get bigger until a point, and then it declines. So, and so they did, you know, the program's designed that way to kind of help on the lower end, on the lower of the lower right. end workers, kind of remove some of that, you know, kind of penalty you get for working or earning more.
Well, what are some of the, what are the main, your report talks about four different industries of workers, and I think we generally know, we can probably guess most low-wage work is service industry work, like fast food, retail, but
yeah.
You look at, you mentioned one here in this study that I think would surprise a lot of people, that how many people are receiving benefits in this particular field of work. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So this is adjunct faculty at colleges and universities. And what we found was a quarter of adjuncts are either themselves or someone in their family is participating in one of these public assistance programs. And we thought that that was a really surprisingly high rate, given the high levels of education and the investment in the careers that adjunct faculty have made and put in. You know, just for context, 25% is the same rate as the overall workforce, but adjunct faculty have, you know, almost all of them have college degrees, and majority of them
degrees.
Have, you know, master's
yeah.
degrees and PhDs.
Right, right. So this, the whole idea that get an education, you'll get a better job, doesn't necessarily pan out in this case.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely are some, it, you know, well, as we found, there are some kind of occupations where, even with a high education, the workers still need to rely on public assistance.
Well, what, you know, what has happened with our wages? I mean, I think we've heard these things, you know, we hear them all the time, but we can't talk about this without just giving a little bit of background on what has happened to wages in the last 30 years, even in the last decade, that's brought us to the point where people who work almost full time are still having to rely on public assistance.
Sure. So nationwide, since the year 2000, on an inflation-adjusted basis, wages have declined actually for the bottom 70% of workers in the U.S. So that means, you know, only the top 30% of workers have seen any raise at all, and the bottom 70 have actually seen their wages fall. And since 1979, wages for the median worker in the U.S., again, on an inflation-adjusted basis, have only risen by 5%, but for the bottom 10%, their wages have fallen 5%. So, exactly. It's this story kind of wage stagnation, and, you know, there's a number of different kind of explanations for why this has occurred, and, you know, especially kind of at the lower end of the income scale, some of the issues have been the kind of stagnant value of the minimum wage. If you adjust the minimum wage for inflation today, it's over, it's almost $2.30 lower than it was in 1968. And so, you know, that the minimum wage is something that, especially at the bottom end of the income scale, is something that make sure that these workers, their wages kind of keep up with the pace of the overall economy. And that's something that, you know, that policy hasn't exactly been accomplishing that.
You are listening to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and I'm speaking with Ian Perry, research analyst at the Center for Labor Research and Education at UC Berkeley, about a recent study on the amount of the government spends on public assistance programs for people who actually have jobs. Well, since we are, you know, in the middle of the country and we span sort of the border between Kansas and Missouri, you looked at these at the state level as well. How do Kansas and Missouri rank in your study?
Sure. So Missouri is, when you look at their total spending on working families, they come in at around, they're in like a 16th place, if you will, where $3 billion a year is spent on working families. And Kansas is actually 35th, where it's spending $900 million a year. And, you know, the total amount of money that you're spending is connected to how many workers you have. So you might also want to think of that as the share of the state's budget for these programs that are going to working families. And for Missouri, that works out to about 57%, and Kansas is about 56%. And that puts them about in the middle of the pack.
Right. So just about the national average, which is kind of what we are on a lot of things around here. But basically, over half of the money being spent is being spent on people who have jobs. And I mean, that kind of brings me to a point. I think we just got a couple of minutes to talk about, like, you know, if what in fact we're doing here is allowing corporations to pay people less because the government is then picking up the slack, you know, what sort of wage level do we need to get to at the bottom to make a serious dent in this amount of assistance going to people who have jobs?
So if you wanted to get to a level where someone was earning enough that they wouldn't be eligible for Medicaid or food stamps or welfare anymore, you'd need to get them to somewhere around 138% of the federal poverty line. That's the cutoff for Medicaid with the ACA expansion. And at that level, the person and their family wouldn't be eligible for welfare or food stamps any longer. So in 2015, that works out to a person needing to make about $22,000 a year if they're a family of two. And so if that person is working full-time and year-round, that would come out to about $11 an hour. The thing is many of these low-wage workers aren't able to work full-time because either they're not scheduled for enough hours during the week or low-wage workers also experience more frequent kind of short spells of unemployment during the year, and that keeps them from working all year round. So realistically, when you think of the total number of hours per year that low-wage workers are able to actually work, they need to earn something around $12 to $14 to kind of get to that level.
And so there you see where, you know, that's why this is that $15. We're getting close to that $15 number that we hear about in the from the low wage worker movement, because that would, you know, allow these folks to not be on public assistance anymore, which I would think would be a good thing that the conservatives would be in favor of, but somehow they can't seem to get it.
Yeah, so that's definitely one side of the one aspect of the benefits of kind of a higher minimum wage. I think when it comes to actually setting the level of the minimum wage, you do need to be a bit careful to just kind of take into account the, ability of the economy to bear a certain wage level. And that's probably more what you want to focus on for setting your minimum wage level. But in any event, a higher minimum wage at any level that's above where it is now is going to result in kind of savings on these programs. And depending on kind of your philosophy, that means either, smaller budgets, or it means money that's available to be better spent on, kind of more targeted programs that can go for, child care or job training.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate your time tonight. This is a great study. We're going to put a link to it up on our webpage, and we'll also put this show up on the web as well after this. I want to thank you for being on the show tonight, Mr. Perry.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ian Perry, research analyst at the Center for Labor Research and Education at UC Berkeley. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says there's sickness and safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ariel for Safety First. First, fine for deadly leak, petty cash for DuPont from www.texastribune.org for May 23rd. More than 6 months after a toxic gas leak killed four workers at DuPont's chemical plant in La Porte, Texas, a top U.S. labor official blasted the company's commitment to workplace safety, saying he wished he could hand out a harsher punishment. We saw serious hazards which killed four people, David Michaels, who heads the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, said in an interview with the Texas Tribune. It's painful for us, and we know it's painful for the family of those workers to see that the fine is only $99,000, a number he called petty cash for the multi-billion-dollar industry. OSHA levied that penalty, the maximum for the citations it issued on May 14th, saying those who died would be alive today had their employer taken steps to protect them. Investigators found multiple serious violations, those that could lead to serious injury or death. The missteps included a failure to train workers and upgrade faulty equipment. The law caps the fine for each such violation at $7,000. Other federal regulators typically dole out far stiffer penalties for violations that probably won't kill people. The Federal Communications Commission, for instance, recently slapped a Virginia TV station with a $325,000 indecency fine. Next, OSHA ruled to protect workers in construction and manufacturing plagued by delays from the International Business News at www.ebtimes.com for May 6th. Federal regulators are delaying health and safety rules that advocates say would save worker lives. The U.S. Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, has spent 8 months reviewing a proposal to strengthen rules on beryllium exposure, overshooting its deadline by 5 months and counting. It's only the latest stumbling block for regulations that already have been more than 13 years in the making. As many as 134,000 workers in the U.S. are currently exposed to beryllium, mostly in aerospace, ceramics, construction, and electronics. When the naturally occurring metal is ground or welded and inhaled, it can cause chronic beryllium disease, a potentially fatal lung disorder. A new rule on beryllium exposure is sorely needed, said Keith Wrightson, a workplace safety expert at Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group pushing for updated beryllium exposure regulations for more than a decade. As it stands, OSHA existing beryllium exposure limit of 2 micrograms per cubic meter dates from research conducted in the 1940s. It's 4 times higher than the limit in China and 10 times higher than the limit for the Department of Energy. In spite of the risks, it's just a typical regulatory delay at OSHA, Wrightson says. Public Citizen and the largest chemical workers union first petitioned the agency for a lower exposure limit back in September 2001. Then there's the political climate teeming with accusations of government overreach. Finally, New York governor orders emergency measures to protect workers at nail salons from www.nytimes.com for May 11th. Governor Andrew Cuomo ordered emergency measures on May 10th to combat wage and theft and health hazards faced by thousands of people who work in the New York State's nail salon industry. Effective immediately, a new multi-agency task force will conduct salon-by-salon investigations, institute new rules that salons must follow to protect manicurists from potentially dangerous chemicals found in nail products, and begin a 6-language education campaign to inform them of their rights. The new rules come in response to a New York Times investigation of nail salons, first published online May 7th and 8th, that detailed widespread exploitation of manicurists, many of whom have illnesses some scientists say are caused by chemicals with which they work. Under new rules, manicurists must wear gloves to reduce the risks of contracting skin conditions such as fungal infections and developing burns from handling chemicals. The plan currently will also require masks, although occupational health experts say hospital-type masks that manicurists sometimes wear give only the appearance of safety. Such masks do almost nothing to prevent exposures to chemicals such as dibutyl phthalate, toluene, and formaldehyde that are used in nail products and have been linked to leukemia and fetal defects. And salons will be required to be ventilated to reduce chemical exposure. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Kansas City minimum wage increase press conference tomorrow, Friday, June 5th at noon, City Hall, 414 East 12th Street. Kansas City Labor Council and the Coalition of Labor Union Women are both meeting Tuesday, the 1st at 5:30, the 2nd at 6:30 at the Argosy Casino in the meeting rooms. How payday lenders drain money from consumers and the KC economy, a community discussion sponsored by CCO, Communities Creating Opportunities, which says payday lenders drain $26 million every year from the Kansas City economy. That's June 11th, 10 a.m. to noon at the Gem Theater, 1615 East 18th Street in Kansas City. And the Midwest School for Women Workers will be July 19th through the 23rd. It's at DePaul. It's actually at Roosevelt University in Chicago. For a brochure and information on scholarships, go to MidwestWomenWorkers.org. You can find our calendar on our website at HeartlandLaborForum.org, where you can also find our upcoming show list and our archived shows. You can still pledge to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. That number is 888-931-0901, or you can pledge online at kkfi.org, and remember us in your will. Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. We're going to have Labor History in 2, a new podcast every day in labor history. What happened this day? 2 minutes. And we're going to be talking to the Venezuelan consul from Chicago, and we're going to ask him, Venezuela, who's the real threat? And talk some about the co-op movement in Venezuela. Thanks to tonight's engineer Jen Zaman. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.